Our next speaker is Rebecca Hensler. She is the founder of Grief Beyond Belief, and that is a support group for grieving people who do not believe in God or an afterlife. Following the death of her son, she discovered the power of peer-to-peer grief support and the alienation and frustration of being the only one grieving without belief in a God or afterlife. Today we're going to hear about her emotional journey, her commitment to healing without mythology or mysticism, and the practical challenges of creating a community from scratch. Her talk today is Grief Beyond Belief, Founding and Growing a Community for Secular Support. So please give a warm welcome to Rebecca.
Hi. So, as you just heard, I'm the grief lady. And that's not anything I ever expected to be. My wife actually has this joke. She says, "You're famous for being sad." And whoever expects to be in that situation. But it was particularly strange for me because I've ended up having my role in the secular movement be one of caretaking. And that is not a role I expected. I was an activist, a street activist, in my early adulthood, pretty much from when I was 18 on. And I wasn't the kind of like you sit down and you talk to the politician activist. I was the like in the street shouting things, going into buildings through broken windows and getting arrested kind of activist. Activism is this awesome use for having an oppositional personality. And I started my adulthood in this sort of bad kid role. And things really changed for me. When I was an activist, I was in the AIDS activist movement. I had come out into the queer community, and even though, unlike older gay men, it wasn't like my old friends were dying. When I came out, like so many people who came out in the late 80s and early 90s, we felt like by the time we were 30, we'd either be dead or at least half or more of our friends would have died. And this made us so angry. And so we're angry all the time. And anger was our response to grief. Even though we were surrounded by the dying, we didn't, for the most part, get grief. We didn't talk about grief. God, we really didn't talk about grief. Except as this fuel for anger, and anger was the fuel for the movement, and with the movement we were going to save our friends. And then we didn't. And people died. And people died, and people died, and people died. And for me, like many people of the time in California, we weren't managing it, that loss and our understanding of death through religion, but I did have one of those sort of vague non-religious spiritualities, a set of beliefs I had pretty much just made up as a teenager. And I held those beliefs and used those beliefs to handle the deaths of friends and loved ones and a lover throughout my 20s and throughout most of my 30s. And then in my late 30s, Greta Christina, who you'll hear later, who is an old friend of mine, started doing a lot of writing about atheism. And I started looking at myself and thinking, do I really want to spend my whole life as this person with beliefs that I have no evidence for? And is that really what a grown-up does? Believe in things because they make you feel good. And so I let go of those beliefs in my late 30s, but I still didn't grow up. I didn't grow up till I got pregnant. which happened when I was 40. I had been told I could never get pregnant. I had literally been told by a fertility specialist that were I to become pregnant without heroic measures of some sort, that they would have to hold a conference to discuss how I'd manage to get pregnant. But in fact, I did manage to get pregnant. And then I found out that my son, my fetus, was developing with a very severe birth defect, a birth defect called CDH, congenital diaphragmatic hernia. The diaphragm is basically the muscle that holds the abdominal organs in the abdomen and the chest organs in the chest. And with this condition, the diaphragm develops with a hole in it, and the abdominal organs move up into the chest, causing defects in the heart and lungs, and causing the heart and lungs to be too small. So my wife and I were told that our son had a 1 in 10 chance of survival. And honestly, one of the hardest decisions I ever made was the decision to carry our son to term. And I knew that one of the possibilities was he would be born with such severe defects that he would never be able to learn or play or do the things that children do. And that was something I never wanted for my son. But he also had this chance of growing into a relatively healthy little boy. And I had amazing health insurance because of my union. And so we decided to give him a chance. He was born. He was beautiful. He had big blue eyes, and he was looking at everything, and he was clearly so smart and so curious. He loved Pink Floyd. He loved A. Milne poetry. He didn't like T.S. Eliot poetry. You know, everyone has their preferences. We had 90 days with him, and his lungs did not develop enough to support his growing body, and he died in my arms when he was 90 days old. So by that time I was a grown up. And by that time, as I said, I'd let go of these beliefs that, you know, I had no evidence for. When you're grieving, grief is like this. You're sort of walking through life, and this hole opens up in front of you. And for a minute, you're Wile E. Coyote. You keep walking, and then you just fall. And so once you're down at the bottom of that hole, I mean, the thing is, there's this rope, right? Called religion or spirituality, and you can grab it. And if you are able to manage a substantial amount of cognitive dissonance, you can hold on to that rope. But if you're thinking rationally, you slide down that rope pretty quickly, and then you're in that hole. And the common meme says that, in fact, there is no comfort for you at the bottom of that hole if you do not have religion or spirituality. So I was at the bottom of that hole, and I started reaching out for support and discovered something that I hadn't even thought about before, which was that at this point, online grief support existed. And online grief support is amazing. Because when you are crying and crying and crying at 1 in the morning, there's someone there to connect with. And for me, that was through an organization called Compassionate Friends. And Compassionate Friends is this, you know, it's been around over 60 years. It's a mainstream peer-to-peer grief support organization for parents. And once there was an internet, you know, it had a very strong presence on Facebook. And so I could reach out. And when you're a grieving parent, you're like a different species. No one gets it but other grieving parents. And I could reach out at 1 in the morning and talk with other grieving parents, and that helped so much. but it was also incredibly alienating and isolating because so many people, the majority of people in the organization itself is non-religious, but the majority of people in the organization had religious or spiritual beliefs. So either they believed that their child was all around them and was sending them messages through butterflies and dreams, or they believed that their child was in heaven. And at first it was just a little irritating, and then there was this one night where this woman, this other grieving mother who had lost an older daughter, said that her daughter, she was sure her daughter was in heaven holding my son, and because her daughter had loved babies. And all I could think is, do you not know the statistics on infant mortality? What are the odds of every baby who dies that your daughter is holding my son? And there I am, like that rope isn't even there for me. So I started thinking about this and thinking all the time about, wouldn't this be great if this exact sort of format existed, but specifically for people who were grieving without belief in an afterlife and without belief in a God. And I had a conversation with Greta about it, and I remember her saying, you know, there are other people thinking about this and writing about it. So I started reading that, and that was really good to see that there are other people out there. And I have to admit, there was this part of me that really wanted one of those other people to please start this organization, please start this website, please start this Facebook group. I was a mess still. And it didn't help that Greta said, well, it's not just grieving parents, you know, there are these, obviously grieving parents are not the only grieving non-believers. And so I was aware that there was a bigger need than I was ready to fill. But eventually, I did really start thinking about starting pretty much something on the exact same model as Compassionate Friends. But I'm just going through and seeing where I'm up to. So starting something that was on the exact same model as Compassionate Friends, but also was very specifically for people who were grieving as non-believers. And luckily, I, with a lot of help, was able to get the word out to the atheist community. So when I started the Facebook page, within the first week, 1,000 people, quote, liked the page and joined this community that would send out a question, a quote, a link to an article, a link to some sort of grief research, a request for support. So people would get this in their newsfeed every day. People would reply to each other. And it wasn't just, you know, that it turned out that there was need. It also turned out that people really were willing to do exactly what I was hoping, which was just be there for each other. Just be there and listen and say, yeah, I've been through that too. So this was really the growth within the secular movement, because the people who had promoted it were part of a secular movement and community. The second phase of Grief Beyond Belief really happened after the first time I gave a talk about it, which was in Berkeley, and a journalist came to me and said I'd be interested in writing an article about this. And that article ended up being published in the Huffington Post in USA Today. And so this was, you know, Grief Beyond Belief had been founded in June of 2011. This was February of 2012, and the community doubled in size, but it was an entirely different population. It was people who had been alone and isolated, people who didn't call themselves atheists, agnostics, whatever, didn't consider themselves part of a community. They were people who were just sort of quietly grieving without belief, and had over and over again I heard them say, I wish this had existed. This is just what I needed. And I also started learning how much being surrounded by religious people was really traumatic to grieving non-believers. It was something that had not really occurred to me because I had not been in that context. That religious people were doing damage to grieving non-believers. And sometimes that was really extreme. I made friends with someone who had been a former evangelical pastor, and I literally on his Facebook page saw a so-called friend say to him that his teenage sons who had died, that God had taken them because he didn't want them to witness their father's shame. Blaming him for the death of his sons. Religious people say crazy ass things to the grieving. Say things that just don't make any sense. You hear people say things like, you know, it's someone else who knows or has a sick baby, and they're like, well, my sick baby lived because my prayers were answered. But your sick baby died because God needed another angel. God has a plan. And I'm like, you know, God's plan involves sick babies? What kind of plan involves sick babies? If I saw that on paper, I'd be like, you know, I don't think we need to think of a better plan here. But grieving people who don't have, you know, religious beliefs, when they get together, they're really able to support each other in really unique ways. And a lot of that is really just understanding each other's anger. One of the things that happened in Grief Beyond Belief is people started asking, can we have, you know, this public page is great, but Facebook had done some, you know, Facebook always like wants to fix problems that aren't there. And so Facebook had done some things so that all of a sudden everything anyone ever posted or commented on the public page was visible to all their friends. And so people stopped participating as much because of that, and they said, can we have a closed group? And while I hadn't wanted to have a closed group when I didn't know whether we were actually be able to bring people into this community, at this point I was like, yes, let's start a closed group. And the closed group is a really amazing community. I have a whole team of volunteers now who essentially vet people who request to join. So we make sure that everyone who joins the closed group is both a non-believer and is themselves grieving, isn't just looking for some kind of secular social group. And by asking some pretty nosy questions, and that, let me tell you, is challenging, we are able to have this group where we know that, in fact, if what you are is really angry at religion or angry at religious people because of what they've said to you in your grief, you're not gonna have to worry that you're gonna hurt someone's feelings when you express that anger. That's one of the things that having this closed group provides. And so we started really discovering what are the things that help. Because that whole thing about there is no comfort when you're down in that hole, if you don't have religion, if you don't have that rope, there's nothing for you. It's not true. We started learning how to kind of help each other up the stairs out, and how to help each other when, you know, you fell back into it again. We started learning that storytelling is comforting. That just being asked, tell me me about this person that you love. We started learning that we could share with each other the meaning we had found, because while the whole thing about phases of grief is honestly a load of crap, and the research, at best the research was badly done, at worst Kubler-Ross was a scam artist, it's not clear exactly which, but there are, it turns out, sort of tasks that help someone with their grief, learn to live with grief. One of them is simply accepting the reality of that, but another is making meaning of the loss. And so we're really able to help each other. You know, for me, the meaning I've made of my loss has a lot to do with the fact that this little boy who never even got to see grass, never got to be outside, has still managed to touch the world in such a profound way by inspiring this, the founding of this community. But we talk about all the ways that we make meaning of our loss and our love. We talk about kind of the ripple effect. People who have lost parents and grandparents talking about, you know, how do you share the things that that person shared with you, with young people who are able to live their lives differently because that person lived, because that person taught you something and you've passed it on. We've learned how much, honestly, in the first part of grief, a lot of what you want is just some damn practical help. And in the later part of grief, that you want people not to forget that you're grieving. That often the non-grieving say things like, you know, well, you know, when are you going to find closure? When are you going to be ready to move on? And that that's not something the grieving say to each other. So Grief Beyond Belief as a community has really changed and grown. For one thing, it's had this amazing impact, not just in the world of grief, but in secular support. Online secular support has exploded since the founding of Grief Beyond Belief. And because I never at the time went and looked how many groups actually existed at the time, but you know, since the founding of Grief Beyond Belief, there is online secular cancer support. I've been diagnosed with MS, there's online secular MS support. There's just an extraordinary number of groups out there that are specifically for people who are providing peer-to-peer support for each other for some sort of life problem that used to be addressed primarily through religion. We have expanded to have our own website. This year has been hell for the independent website. We were hacked, and then we were hacked again, and not hacked by like people who think that we're bad, hacked by people who thought it was a good idea to use a grief site to put out like porn, literally. And then a catastrophic server crash, and so it's been really problematic. But when the website is working, one of the most amazing things about it is that we have what is called the Secular Grief Library. So when people say, I want to read something, I want to listen to a podcast, I want to watch a video, I want something about grief that I know doesn't have religion or spirituality in it, we have over 300 links to writing, audio, and video about grief that has no religion or spiritual content. And that's an amazing thing. Also, I've started trying to sort of expand Grief Beyond Belief into the real world, not just by going out and talking, but by experimenting with doing secular grief support workshops. And also, I have this year been working on a handbook that's for community organizers, for local organizers like many of you, If you feel like there is a need for secular grief support in your community, how to make that happen, how to figure out what's needed, how to figure out what the steps are to make that happen. And that's one of the things I want to sort of bring this to a close with, is the topic of what can you do? If you have an idea, if you feel like there is some kind of support that is needed in your community, I didn't think, like I said, I did not think I was going to end up being the grief lady. But I can't tell you enough to take your idea and try and make it real. That this is important work. That not just grief support, but caretaking of all kinds is important work. And I was thinking about this today, and I'm going to put on my glasses now so I can actually read this to you. Because these are some new thoughts, and I was writing them down rather than just sort of thinking about them. And this is my thought on the importance of caretakers within a movement. And when I say this movement, I both mean the secular movement and I mean the resistance that so many of us are involved in right now. We cannot all be firebrands for a multitude of reasons, both external and internal. Even those of us who have been firebrands in the past or will be firebrands in the future can't all be firebrands right now. There is space in this movement, of course, for activists and politicians. And there's space in this movement for bloggers and for podcasters, for people who make YouTube videos, for journalists. There's space for artists, poets and scientists, and teachers and researchers. But there's also space in this movement for counselors and facilitators and just plain listeners, for caretakers. Caretaking, comforting the grieving without lying to them, sharing compassion with the sorrowing without ever giving in to the pressure to echo platitudes or agree with things you don't believe, gathering the hurting together to comfort and advise each other, counseling those whose beliefs you don't share with respect, both for them and for yourself, nurturing and nourishing and teaching youth who are under attack for their beliefs or their lack of documents or their race or who they love, seeing and hearing and standing beside people when our culture and government says their lives don't matter, caretaking simply by witnessing another's pain, even when it's hard as hell, is an act of resistance. If what you have in you right now is the strength to listen to other people's pain, or the connectedness to gather people together, or the even temper it takes to facilitate conversation once angry and hurt people are gathered together, or the capacity and resources to nourish with good food or a warm, safe place to stay, or the organization to guide a good idea into a sustainable community, or simply the patience to wait on a sidewalk until the very last protester arrested has been released. You are needed now more than ever. Do not ever let anyone take your emotional work for granted. It is not owed to anyone, least of all your oppressors. But don't ever let anyone tell you that your social and emotional skills and strength are not part of the resistance. Thank you.
about 15 minutes for questions. If you raise your hand, I'll come hop on over and give you the microphone. So just raise your hand.
Hi, I was wondering, if you had any, so you work with people who are secular and grieving, and do you, you probably don't have, experience with this exact thing, but, being a secular person who's, comforting a religious person who's grieving, I just have, I was in high school and, dating someone who, was, vaguely religious and his dad had just passed away and was, kind of using religion to cope with that, and then he was like, but if you're an atheist, do you just think that my dad's gone, I'm never gonna see him again? And I was like, yeah, it is. So, I don't know if you just have any, advice kind of for dealing with that.
It's an interesting question. It is one that comes up at Grief Beyond Belief. It's something we've discussed a lot. I think one of the things worth knowing is that, in fact, a lot of religious people don't like the bullshit either. So there is no grieving parent I have ever met who is okay with being told they're in a better place. There is, it does not matter if that better place in their mind is Jesus's arms. If you say to a grieving parent, your child is in a better place, their immediate response is, there is no better place for a child than in their parents' arms. And so that's one thing that's really important to remember, is that a lot of those platitudes make grieving people of all sorts very unhappy. And similarly, a lot of the comforts that comfort secular people are also comforting. So storytelling is a universal response to loss. People say all the time, religious people say, I couldn't stand that religious funeral, I couldn't stand that preacher who didn't even know my dad, and there he is, and he's talking about Jesus, and he's not talking about my dad, and why do we have that guy who didn't even know my dad talking? Really, all anyone wants at a memorial is to take the time to remember who the person was, with love and compassion and with humor and with joy, and kind of carry that person on through storytelling into the world we live in now. And really, so many of the things that are comforting to non-believers are also comforting to believers. And so I really recommend, when someone says, how do I comfort my religious friend? Honestly, the same way you'd comfort a non-believer.
Hi. I was wondering if you have any suggestions on how to deal with a situation, and it's not death, but often you'll get a response from somebody, oh, your mother's having surgery, I'll be praying for her. Oh, you're going to have surgery, I'll be praying for you. And to me, I want to say, well, that doesn't mean anything to me, but how would one tactfully respond to that, or do you just keep letting it go?
Honestly, the most tactful way to respond to that, I mean, if tact is what you want, and rather than maybe a feeling of satisfaction of be like, could you do my laundry instead, because I need to be in the hospital with my mom right now. But if tact is what you want, then honestly, a response where you kind of pretend they didn't say praying. You pretend they said thinking, and you say, you know, thank you so much for thinking of me and my family in this time, and you move on from it.
I found the website or the Facebook page, and so I'm part of it. I've posted very sporadically. I find it's pretty hard to read, because it can be pretty, it's got a lot of really deep grief to it. Mostly, I just wanted to say thank you. I think it's something that was definitely needed, and I'm sorry that it came about through the death of your son. But I just want to say thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Hi, I was wondering what gave you the strength to start your website, because I know that you were in the middle of grieving and that it was something that was very new to you. So how did you go about that process?
Part of it was that I did wait. I waited not quite 2 years. When I had the idea and when I so desperately wished that this community existed, I knew I wasn't ready yet, and so I kind of made myself wait. And in the meantime, I was still like, please, someone else start this group. I don't really want to be the one, right? And I get impatient sometimes. I'll tell you something I think is funny. So a couple weeks ago, there was on President's Day, there was a demonstration planned, and of course in San Francisco, it's been pouring and pouring and pouring for over a month, and so there we were, out in the rain, and I got so impatient. I was like, "Let's all go over to this building and hold up our signs over here," and like literally dragged the handful of people who'd actually come out in the rain, like, come on, over here, we're gonna hold our signs over here, because I get impatient. And so I honestly wouldn't call it strength. I am driven by this tendency to, when I want something to happen, if no one else will do it, I just kind of get cranky and make it happen myself.
I just wanted to, again, thank you for this topic. And I see a lot of parallels between talking about grief and talking about atheism, because based on some of the questions that have come in, it seems that people are scared of, a lot of people's questions were relating to, how do I support somebody? They're scared of their fellow grievers. And it's a taboo topic that people don't talk about enough. When most people die, the funeral home is taking care of everything, and you get to remove yourself from it. But as a fellow griever, I definitely understand the drive to talk about grief all the time. 3.5 years ago, my husband committed suicide, so it's made me a more activist person, actually, and it's making me talk about it more and more, and reaching out to people again is, I think, the best thing for us non-believers, is just have people around you at all times.
Thank you.
So I've got my two girls here sitting next to me, 12 and 9 here.
Oh, no,
so.
Sorry, I cussed.
Yeah, so I so I just did I want to kind of tilt the question more in that direction. So I had, this is getting to be, I don't know, 10 years or so ago, a boss of mine died suddenly. And I remember being at her funeral, and her two kids about my daughter's age were there. And, you know, it was at a funeral, and it was very religious, and I'm not. And so, you know, I don't know that I said anything terribly profound or compelling. So if I get hit by a bus tomorrow, what would you have to say to my girls?
Yeah, don't put me on the spot or anything. I actually did write a chapter for the new edition of Parenting Beyond Belief that's very specifically about how to take care of grieving kids. In order to do that, what I did was actually reach out to people in the Grief Beyond Belief community and ask them what were the things, in retrospect, what were the things that they felt like had been really helpful with their kids. And I think it's different when you're talking about someone else's child, but the things that appear to be helpful with kids is, one, to really be honest with them. Kids don't actually deal that well with things that are made up, and a lot of the euphemisms and sort of a lot of the things we do to make grief easier on kids are honestly just confusing to them. So people tell kids things like, grandma went to sleep and did not wake up. It can cause absolute terror of falling asleep in a child, because then they think, wow, that could happen to me. And so the things we say to make it gentler often are just things that upset kids more. Being honest, listening, being there for them when they are in their sorrow and in their feelings, and also not trying to hide your own feelings from them. You know, not necessarily having them see you when you're absolutely overwhelmed and out of control, but sharing your grief with them is a kindness to a child, because it lets them see that it is possible to have those emotions and to live with them, to cry your eyes out and the next day to go on.
Can we get a hand for Rebecca, please?